welcome to Androids and Assets. I'm Steven.
And I'm Marshall.
And this is the show where we talk about the political economy of speculative fiction. That is, how decisions are made, how wealth is distributed, and how billionaires are no match for walking nuclear reactors. Today, we are very lucky to be talking about the Kaiju Preservation Society, and we are joined by its author, John Scalzi. John is the winner of the Hugo and Locus Award, among others. He has, to his credit, almost too many publications to count, but among the most notable works are the Old Man's War series, the Dispatcher series, and as well as numerous standalone novels such as Red Shirts. Welcome, John.
Thank you. It's good to be here. I am ready to talk about monsters and economies.
Fantastic. Monstrous economies, even.
Yes.
When we have authors on, I give them the opportunity to give us the long line, but I also have one in reserve as well. So whatever if you want to give it or you want us to give it.
I mean, basically the way that I've been saying it to people is, Kaiju Preservation Society, it's got monsters and friends and nuclear explosions. That's pretty much the way I go with that.
That's very astute. The novel follows Jamie Gray on his journey from being a member of an upstart, fast-growing tech company to near destitution working as a gig worker and back again to an exciting career in the public service. And it's not the public service, but it's not the public service you think, because yes, it involves monsters, specifically Kaiju. Mm-hmm. So, and the Kaiju are very interesting. I hope I'm not giving anything away here, but the Kaiju are very interesting because they exist in it's a parallel Earth, right?
Yeah, it's parallel.
Parallel universe. Yeah, where evolution took a different course. Giant monsters with nuclear reactors inside them became the predominant life on Earth. At some point, humans started going over there. And so as a result, because it was in the 20th century, I guess, that the discovery was made, it became a matter of it was handled by governments and international agencies who largely protect the secret of this parallel Earth and the Kaiju. Hence the Kaiju Preservation Society. So this book is very interesting for us because it's directly about people working in the civil service and people working, and also people having a lot of interaction with business.
I don't know. I mean, you say it's a civil service, but it's more of like an NGO, right? Like it's like,
I guess that's
they get funding, but they're not actually like part of any specific government.
That's true.
Right. They're right. Yeah, no, I mean, the basic concept of it is it is going to have to be there are many stakeholders, but they're all at the governmental level. And so they are going to have to be an NGO that is answerable to several governments, but does not have to be beholden to a specific one. Now, in the real world, what that basically means is it's mostly dealt with by, two or three specific superpowers at whatever the superpowers are at the moment, but also other people get nations get their buy-in, and so in many ways this is very much of just what your, I don't want to say your normal NGO would be, but it is very definitely modeled on, we are an organization that interfaces primarily with governments rather than industry or with people per se. So how is that going to function? Now, with that said, what also happens is, because this is a completely off the book sort of thing and everybody agrees with this, is it's going to be difficult for us to consistently black box this in a way that the Washington Post is not going to find out about it. They do have to go and interface directly with business, and particularly billionaires, particularly nerd billionaires, who would see it as totally in their wheelhouse to just pop off $100 million to help finance this, and in return, get to see Godzilla.
Worth it.
I mean, if I had a hundred, I mean, we've got, what do you got? You got people spending $20 million to go into space, and not even necessarily into space, but just to sort of get into the upper atmosphere. Given the,
for seconds.
Yeah. It's like, ooh, I'm a little bit of weightless, you know, but the thing is that I mean, honestly, when you have as much money as those folks have, it is literally, you know, it's not even a question of whether or not you can afford it. It's more fascinating to be able to look at it as a percentage and what it means. Like, I remember it was like 10 years ago or more now, where Jeffrey Bezos bought the Washington Post, which, by the way, I was happy he did, because he has just completely opened up the money bags for them. So that was great. But the thing about it was, is, you know, that he paid a certain amount of money for it. And given his worth at the time, that would have been like a normal person buying a laptop, right? As a percentage of his income, or not his income, but his worth. And you think about that. It's like the Washington Post is his laptop. You know, so of course these people are going to spend $20 million on a couple of seconds of weightlessness, you know, in a tin can, because it's not about the money. It is about the experience. It's about the bragging rights and so on and so forth. So again, in the case of the Kaiju Preservation Society, the bragging rights of Godzilla are, you literally can't top it.
But I think with a lot of billionaires, they want a lot for their money, and maybe, well, might not just be content.
Yeah, we don't want to.
Okay, right.
Yes,
fair enough.
No, yeah. We don't want to get into spoiler territory. But I do think it is very clear in the course of the books that billionaires are going to billionaire, right? when you are literally worth more. Then it takes the average, you know, the average person would have to spend 20,000 years to even get a fraction of what you're worth. Then, yeah, your own sense of your personal value and the value of your opinions and the value of your plans is irretrievably skewed, right? And so you really have to function that in. I mean, it's not only the Kaiju Preservation Society, but it is the Billionaires Handler Society as well. Right. Because the sort of expectation management you have to deal with when you are dealing with billionaires who have a set of interests, expectations and desires that are unfathomable to the people who just do not have that same access to capital or wealth or whatever, is an entirely thing. Billionaires are an alien species. I mean, it's just the best way to look at them. They are not like normal people. It's like F. Scott Fitzgerald was right. The rich are different from the rest of us. They're not even the same species.
Yeah.
So, I mean, like you said, billionaires are going to billionaire, and billionaires love to talk about science and like the cool things that they're funding and the things that they're doing. Or about like journalism with buying the Washington Post. Like, yeah, you know, this is a super important institution. But really, from what I have been able to tell, those things are quite secondary, right? They have all these ulterior motives of basically like making more money, right? Or like Elon Musk is like, he's out there talking about all of the science that he's funding. But really, he only seems interested in how much money he actually has, not whether there's that scientific advancement is actually happening or how quickly or who, how many people it's helping. It's like, well, yeah, but I'm now the richest man. So like, haha.
Sure. I mean, the thing is, I mean, I am not Elon Musk and I don't exist in his head. And I think we're all very happy about that. But I have to think that the answer to that is a little bit more complex. There is the thing of, you know, everybody's going to dick wave, right? You know, and when you get to the point where you are worth, you know, $100 billion, then you want to be worth $200 billion just to stick it to Warren Buffett, right? You know, it's like the billionaires exist in a small town, right? And the small town is the hyper rich, right? And just like, you know, you want to have a cooler car than your neighbor or cooler power mower or whatever. You want to have the, if you're a billionaire, you want the cooler accoutrement. Now, does this mean that Elon Musk is not interested in the science? Not necessarily. He may absolutely be interested in the science. So many of the things that he funds are reliant on science, or at the very least engineering, right? And there is the capacity for the things that he is doing to have the spinoff benefits as well as the direct benefits. But certainly he is always looking, and I think most of the billionaire class right now is always looking at the bottom line of, I am funding this, how can I exploit this? Now, there's also the thing of the competitive philanthropy, right? Which is, you know, the thing where the Gates Foundation comes in, or Carnegie's, if you want to go all the way back, where they have like, I have sucked the world dry. My monopoly has crushed all. Now it is time for me to give back. Here's a library, you know, and again, you know, not to dispute the benefit of the Carnegie Libraries, and also not to completely denigrate the work of the Gates Foundation in, for example, helping to eradicate like nematode infestations in Africa and all this sort of stuff. Good stuff can be done. But you do have to, I think what your point is a lot of that really is centered on not necessarily the common good, but the question of what is it that tickles the ego of this particular billionaire? Is it philanthropy? Is it science? Is it art? You know, you got the Sacklers who have moved into art and stuff like that. And all it cost was an entire generation of people addicted to OxyContin, you know, but what price progress, right? And this is, you know, again, the part of the psychology of billionaires, which is honestly, what way can you approach them that their ego allows them to do laudable and useful things and not just dick wave?
So I was thinking where you said they're like the handlers. It seems like if you don't handle them properly or handle them well, you can end up with like super bruised egos, and then somebody is on Twitter talking about, you know, how he deserves a cookie for paying taxes. Even worse, goes on to support like far right wing terrorist movements because he's also oppressed, and so. It seems like somebody's just sort of like didn't handle them well and expectations weren't met. And then they just kind of went off the deep end.
I was about to say, I know you're both Canadian, so things are very tender for you right now. So, I mean, I appreciate that. It's like, whereas Americans over here going, well, shit, that's just Tuesday. Right.
Your occupation was a year ago, so it's had time to kind of like scab over. Ours is fresh.
Right, exactly. So, no, but I think yes, absolutely. Anybody who has ever spent any time in the philanthropic sector, right, knows that one of the most important jobs is making sure that your benefactors feel valued and appreciated and in on what's going on. And because the moment that they feel like you're just there for the money, whether or not you are actually there for just for the money or not, then the money goes away, right? Everybody wants to feel that they have value. One of the things about the, you know, I've talked about before, what I talked about in Lock-In, which is a previous book that again deals with the issue of millionaires and how they interact with each other, is that a primary motivator or the primary currency for billionaires is not really money, but intangibles like time and effort and presence and things like that, because they have effectively a limitless amount of money, right? But they have a finite amount of time and they have a finite amount of attention that they can give to things. And so when you are dealing with millionaires and billionaires and people like that, you have to address the things that they value because the money is so common that they just don't even feel it anymore, right? Except in context to other billionaires and stuff like that. So, and so when you're talking about, you know, having to tread lightly on the egos of the billionaires, absolutely. If you need something from the billionaires, which, as it turns out, we've tuned our society to do, at least since the previous Gilded Age, then yeah, you actually do have to pay attention. You know, is this billionaire a man-child? Well, that's too bad, you know, because he's got all this money. Does this billionaire really actually get excited about, you know, only this one thing? Well, good for you, because you get to now spend 20 meetings talking about how to trigger that one good feeling this billionaire has so that they will give you $20 million for your endeavor or whatever. And it sucks, but also this is not any different than any other sort of lobbying, right? A lobbyist, you know, goes in, how do I handle this senator? Or how do I handle this MP, right? You know, or when you, you know, right down to, you know, the Girl Scouts selling Girl Scout cookies, right? How do I get people to buy the Girl Scout cookies? I mean, one answer that we've discovered down here in the US is park in front of a legal weed store, right? Because one leads to the other. But ultimately, with every personal transaction, handling is part of it, and a significant part of it.
Transition towards like a court mentality, right? Like a courtly mentality that like you have to, there is a king, there's an important person, and you have to like, or a network of important people, and you need to manage them to achieve your goals. Because, and again, let me know if this is a spoiler, but like Jamie, part of Jamie's job ends up being handling the billionaires.
My comment here is I challenge your use of the word transitioning, because I don't think that much has changed. I mean, the thing is, humans are gregarious primates, and humans are hierarchical primates. And basically every society that we have devised in terms of civilizations ends up with hierarchies, ends up with people focused up at the top of the power and a larger number of people not, you know. And whether you want to call them kings or administrators or presidents or billionaires or whatever, ultimately the concentration of power rests either in a figurative individual or a aristocracy, you know, but basically that pyramidal structure. What we seem to do is we replicate that at relationship dynamic, regardless of what economic or social model that we end up, you know, trying to overlay on it. You know, even when they tried, you know, pure communism, you know, welcome Conrad. It didn't work because there was still Lenin and Stalin and, you know, all those folks up at the top of the pyramid. There was no base equality. There was always that dynamic. So when we are feeding billionaires, it's the same thing that we have done in time immemorial. You know, the expression "Richus Crucis" has been around for centuries and millennia. We have always had the billionaires. We have always had the people at the top of the economic and social structure.
I don't entirely disagree. I would only push back and say some people have tried to have a less hierarchical or non-hierarchical society, and the hierarchies really hammer on those pretty hard and fast.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I think you can have flat society. You can make it work. I have
just with like an American society beside it, because it's very threatening for them.
Well, but also I think that it has to be a fairly small divide, right?
Yeah.
Like flat structures work best basically when you can see everybody, right? When it comes to when you start adding size, it starts actually, you know, I would say that somebody would argue that it becomes more efficient to have a hierarchy. Whether that's true or not, I'm not qualified to say. I'm, you know, one of the things I always want to present when I pontificate is that sometimes I am way, way out in the weeds, and I am talking to hear myself talk, and really, it sure sounds impressive to me, but I think it's completely bullshit. So.
It's three white guys on a podcast. So, like, if we're not talking to hear ourselves talk, what are we even doing here?
Welcome to White Training Live.
It's like classless. It's almost so when you go through to the parallel Earth, the Kaiju Preservation Society is almost that. Like, it seems like it's almost non-hierarchical. Like, everyone does their own jobs. And there's jobs given and requested and stuff, but it's sort of like, if you're the expert on that thing, yeah, you're the one, just go do your thing.
Sure. I mean, that is true, but it's also the case, to get back to something I said earlier, that the bases also tend to be fairly small in size, right?
Exactly.
There are about 150 people at the base where most of the action takes place. All of them have specialized roles, but within the context of the base, they all have to chip in or shit just doesn't get done, right? Yep. So not only so you have someone like Jamie, whose job literally is I lift things, but everybody is expected to, for example, work in the greenhouse pollinating plants, right? You put in your hour of pollinating, because if you don't, then the plants die, and the knock-on effects from there are pretty grim. In many ways, this would be like when you have to go back to another science fiction metaphor, where you have a spaceship, right? Where you're never not on the job when you're on a spaceship, because it is so small and the tasks are so important that you can't have any free riders. You can't have any people who are just like, oh, I will just manage. No, you don't manage. You get to go clean out the filter because it's your turn to clean out the filter. Because if you don't do it, it doesn't get done. And we all die of oxygen starvation, right? To the same effect. That's the case with the Kaiju Preservation Society. It's flat in places where it can be, but also everybody involved understands that structure works best there, and they all are agreed that they are. There for that particular purpose. When the great thing about fiction is that you can create your little pocket universes the way that you want to create them. And so for the base that we have most of the event at, or the story at, everybody's in agreement. Yeah, we all need to pitch in. We don't have someone who's all of a sudden, well, I would prefer not to. I only want to do this one thing. Because, on one hand, if that person probably exists somewhere on the line and they don't get to come back, for one. And the second thing is that when that happens, things can move quickly enough that can be corrected, as opposed to festering, which you might have with a larger society, because, again, you can't see everybody and the impact is not immediate.
Yeah, and a whole bunch of things that are part of human life don't happen there, right? No one's raising children. No one is growing old and dying there.
Sure.
No one is a quadriplegic there, yeah. Right? If that happens, they go back, right? So there's
Well, yeah, like I said, one of the great things about fiction is you do get to design the pocket universe, right? Now, interestingly, one of the things that I put in the book that I don't think that people notice because I brought no attention to it is the topology of the base is actually flat, right? So it is, in fact, all accessible except for the jungle floor. And the jungle floor, you can take an elevator down, right? So if someone were a quadriplegic and had skills, they could absolutely go there and they could participate and they could do that sort of stuff. But again, for the purposes of this specific story, that wasn't the case. So your main point actually holds perfectly well. I have designed this world to tell this specific story, and all the rest of it, even if I put it into the world building, is not immediately present for people to necessarily directly access.
Yeah, and I don't mean that as a criticism. There's tons of places where they're just like, particularly on frontiers or in military bases.
Oh no, I didn't.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, it wasn't. I didn't take it as a criticism. It was more of, there was more of an opportunity to be like, you know, the things that you think about when you are world building that don't necessarily make it onto the stage. And I'll give Lachin as another example of that, because it took place in the then near future where there had been a pandemic, and how that pandemic would distribute itself and how it would go and all that sort of stuff. And there was no way to put any of that into the book because I was telling a murder mystery, right? And so at the end of writing the novel, the first novel, Lachin, I actually wrote a novella that was a history of the Hayden syndrome, which was the disease that happened in 25 years before the events of the story, partly just to show off all the world building and be like, see how much I thought about this. Isn't this cool? Isn't it all the sort of stuff that I did? And so this was me, you know, going in, going, yes, this is another perfect example of all this world building that you do to make it plausible so that when the people arrive, there's nothing that that catches the reader and makes them step out of the story to go, now, wait a minute, that wouldn't work. So, for example, you know, it's like you break your leg at the base. What does that mean for you? It's like, well, we give you crutches. The good news is we don't have much in the way of stairs, right? And so those are things that you think about, but you don't necessarily, this particular story didn't involve them, although we do have someone screw up their leg. But again, that's part of world building.
Speaking of world building, I think this is the first book I ever read that was set in the winter, in late winter, spring 2020. I think I can safely say this is the first book I've read that has that setting, as it, you know,
right.
Retroactively rather than predictively. And I gotta right. say it was surreal. It was wild.
Sure. There will be more. I promise you. Yeah. I mean, they're already beginning to come out. But the lead time for publication has now been sufficiently played out. It was actually interesting for me because as I was writing it, it starts in March of 2020 and goes through March of 2021. The span of time in this particular book. And as I was writing it, two things were happening. One, I had Google Calendar out and I was literally marking the specific days where specific things were happening. And that was important. Like, for example, I have a whole group of people travel to a particular airbase, right? And they land on at that particular airbase at a particular date and a particular time. And so I had to research the actual weather patterns at that airbase at that particular date and that particular time. I also had to, and you'll appreciate this as Canadians, there's a portion of events that take place in Canada. And I also had to check the weather in Canada on those particular days, right? And again, nobody is going to know this but me, except now you and anybody who listens to this stuff. But if somebody had been at that particular airbase on that particular day and read the book, they'd be like, oh my God, he got that right. This is exactly the way it was on that particular day. How does that happen? How did he know? It's like, thank you, internet. But that's exactly what you want to do. You want to be able to have the actual, if you are writing in a present time, you want to make sure that all the details match up, because there is some nerd somewhere who will absolutely 100% nail you to the wall for not getting that right. And one of the really funny things about this is the book ends, and this, I swear to God, and I've said this before and I will say it again, I swear to God, I did not intend it this way, but literally the book ends the day I finished the book, right?
You say that so in the afterword.
Like, this was not, yeah, yeah. It's like, I didn't mean for that to happen, but the schedule worked out that way. It's like literally I could, as I was writing it, I could see the events getting closer and closer and closer to me. I'm like, I don't want to go into it. I don't know what's going to happen on March 30th.
Yeah. I was going to ask if you had to come to Canada and do some like on-site research, you know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Up to Newfoundland and
yeah, no, I gotta tell you, I mean, go to Goose Lake. I've been for many years and kind of a closet Canadiaphile, right? It's not something that you talk about much because it's not particularly interesting, right? You know, it's like, I'm kind of really No. I mean, it's the, you know, the thing, it's because Canada, from an American point of view, is our view is you are us, only politer and slightly more repressed, you know, and all that sort of stuff. So to say, which is not true, by the way, you know, you definitely have a very specific national identity, but you know, but the thing is, so if you are interested in, like, for example, like I can rattle off a whole bunch of Canadian artists that I love, you know, Daniel Lanois, Sarah Harmer, you know, Sarah McLachlan, of course, but she's big. All of these sorts of, you know, the Rhea Stats, right? Going all the way back to the 1990s for that one. But, you know, it's just all of these things. And people are like, "What? Who are these people? Why do you care?" It's like, they are Juno Award winning, you know, musicians. You need to be paying attention here, right? So to actually get to do a little bit of Canadian flavored research, right? Was actually pretty cool. There are some very specific Canadian Easter eggs in there, I do expect a couple of Canadians to be like, "So you know that person is named after a person who's actually Canadian, right?" And I'll be like, "Yes, no, I got that. I was there for that."
That's actually my joke. Oh, the some of the COVID things, like with the masking and the vaccine and everything.
Yeah.
Would you change any of that, writing it again about, like, sort of the, maybe not how the rules were enforced, but like how people felt about the rules? Because it seemed like there was sort of like a, "Oh, well, I don't need to mask. I have the vaccine now," which is maybe accurate. But like, I think scientists are going to be like, "No, keep wearing it.
Keep wearing the mask." My in-world explanation for this is that the COVID vaccine that they got was demonstrably better. there's that. But no, there is, I mean, there is one scene where a character unmasks and says, "I'm not worried about you. So you can unmask if you want." And the other character's like, "No, I'm gonna keep my mask on, thanks." You know what I mean? So, you know, a little bit of that there. And then also a little bit of when they were like saying, you know, it's like, "We're gonna," you know, they're on a plane ride and they're like, "You're gonna have to stay masked the entire way." And people are like, "Ugh." And they're like, "I don't want to hear you complaining. I don't want to hear this. It's bullshit. Just deal with it." Right. So there was some of that. And at the very end, I had to actually amend, because during the editing process, I was watching COVID levels rise in the United States. And so there was a particular statement that I wanted to finesse so that it didn't look entirely like wishful thinking. And whether or not that is successful or not is fine. But it is absolutely true that in March of 2021, we were looking around going, maybe we've pulled through. maybe we can actually go see people now. Maybe this will work. And then Delta showed up and went, hey, I'm going to be here on the front porch. And we're like, Delta, what are you doing? And then, of course, Omicron showed up, and it didn't bother with the front porch. It was in our bathtub, right? It was like, oh, you want to use the bathtub? And sorry, I'm just going to stink up the place. And that is the frustration of real world immediate prognostication, because you're like, oh, we could be coming out of the, oh, nope, guess not. Let me just tweak that in the editing phase.
So I guess
I'll always assume the worst.
Yeah. Cynicism is seldom punished. So one of the other things I do want to talk about is nuclear power, because I am a big nuclear power fanatic, very interested, and it plays a weird, interesting role in this book. I think one of the things Marshall and I say is that, you know, every science fiction book written now that's not in the extremely far future has to address climate change, and your book absolutely does.
Sure.
So I guess, like, how do you see this book interfacing with the climate change discourse and the energy transformation discourse, like, that needs to happen?
I mean, one of the interesting things about the Kaiju planet, right, the alternate world, alternate Earth on which this all takes place in, is the development of energy systems there, right? And what they work out and how they work out and how they derive energy. And I actually had a pretty fun deep dive thinking about things like, okay, how does wind energy work here? How does solar work here? How does nuclear power, which again, it plays an interesting and complex role in the proceedings, and what are the advantages and disadvantages and dangers actually on the Kaiju planet of having a long running sustained nuclear reaction ongoing on that particular planet? And I won't get into that here, because that is something that I think people need to sort of enjoy within the context of the story itself. But it is absolutely something that I had to be thinking about. It's like, if you could have had a, you know, pebble reactor and just bring it over, you know, because it's about the right size to power one of these bases. They're like, do you think that's wise, all things considered? Let us go three or four steps and see how that works out. And we do have some discussion within the context of the book about some very specific type of nuclear devices, not fission or fusion reactors, but a very specific alternate type of nuclear energy source that has ramifications within the context of the book. So that was interesting to sort of develop there. But also the thing of when I was doing things like talking about, you know, they have dirigibles, right? And how the dirigibles are powered and how the helicopters are powered and all of that sort of stuff, you know, and whether or not they're, you know, drilling, you know, underneath the Canadian Shield for oil there, or where, you know, or whatever.
You're going to have a hard time doing that.
Spend a lot of time thinking about. Yes, no kidding. But that's the whole thing is like, so you do have, I had to spend actually a not inconsiderable time thinking about what are the power requirements? What is needed? How are they going to make it work? Are they going to be able to do stuff? Now, all of the technology for energy within the context of the book is technology that already exists, right? There's nothing about the energy development and implementation on Kaiju Earth that is speculative. Literally, the only thing that was speculative at the point that I started writing was the status of the COVID vaccine. Like, that's it. Everything else is literally off the shelf technology that exists. It might be relatively unusual technology. It might not be technology that is feasible or makes economic sense on this planet, but for what they're doing on the Kaiju planet, it makes sense. Because again, Kaiju planet does not have the same, it has budgetary concerns and so on and so forth, you know, but on the day-to-day basis, money does not play a role in how they are living life or how they're doing their science, all that sort of stuff. They get to live in the socialist utopia, as it were, of pure science. And that being the case, you look at, you know, it's like, okay, what if, you know, what does it cost to have a machine that actually does create hydrocarbon fuels out of literally thin air? Well, over here, it costs a lot. Over there, who cares?
Because it's interesting, because the world, Kaiju Earth is the post-climate, is a hotter planet. It's a greenhouse gas atmosphere-filled planet. It's hot, planet. Right?
Yeah. Well, it's basically the model that I used was the world of the dinosaurs, right? I mean, leaving aside everything that the humans are doing to the planet, and let us stipulate we are doing things to the planet. This, let's not even leave that in doubt. Pulling that out, the Earth, you know, the Earth goes through cycles, and we get warm and we get cold and we get warm and we get cold. And they're not necessarily predictable cycles, but they are definitely things that have happened. We have had a number of times in the past where we have had a much warmer planet than we have now. We have had times where, in the very recent past, where all of all of the North American continent up to basically Boston and Chicago were under a kilometer of ice at least. So, you know, these things go back and forth. For the world that I needed to posit in order to have the Kaiju even vaguely plausible, right? Which again is something that is addressed directly in the course of the book. But it needed to be a much warmer planet than it is. And what are the results of that? And you're right, the world that they live in would be very much like 200 years from now if we don't actually get our hydrocarbon addictions under control.
If we actually bring back the dinosaurs by burning them, putting them back, right. Right. Petroleum does not come from dinosaurs; it's plants or something. I don't care. I guess the other thing I want to talk about, kind of as a lead off from energy, is regulation, because like there's a thing where you have businesses, particularly, and again, maybe this is not somewhere we can go, but in terms of like a major U.S. regulator allows itself to become involved in some shady business dealings here. And what is the inspiration for that? for you, in terms of like regulation, like the role of government and business and the way they intersect to make decisions, particularly around energy.
With regard to regulatory bodies and their interaction in the Kaiju Preservation Society, again, you're correct, we don't want to get too much into it because there would be spoilers. But the thing is in the United States, where I live, we recently had a government that was both very business oriented and also incredibly not competent, right? That they were doing a lot of things that just bluntly, and were not about politics necessarily, is the usual United States divide goes, but was just literally a pure grifter capitalism sort of thing, right? And since, again, I was making a story that was taking place within a particular chunk of time, that was one thing that needed to be addressed. Now, that said, pure grifter capitalism did not start in the United States in 2016 or 2017.
No, it did not.
I need to be very, very clear about this. And so as much antipathy as I have for the previous United States administration, it is not the first to build on that particular model, just possibly the least competent. And particularly in the 1950s and 60s, where in addition to, you know, what's great for GM is what's great for America sort of mindset, and also the Cold War mindset, and also all that other sort of things, it makes perfect sense that a particular regulatory entity might bow and scrape to the people that it is meant to actually regulate. This has always been the problem, you know, frankly, when you have the church mouse as the regulator, you know, for the fat cat, right? Because at the end of the day, there is always an exploit the fat cat can do, right? You know, slip them some money. And, you know, what does it matter? It's one little thing. And now my daughter gets to go to Dartmouth, you know, or whatever, right? So as far as it goes, you do actually have to, incorporate the knowledge of the world that you live in, plus knowledge of how humans work, and also, you know, what works for your story. It really works for my story to have this regulatory body be easily corruptible. So, you know, certainly that makes it easier, as opposed to a plucky band of regulators who are absolutely, you know, Simon pure in their virtue, right? Which would be great. That's the world I want to live in.
It's like, your money is worthless to me, billionaire Bob.
You know, I want to live in that universe. But for the story I'm telling in that universe, that's not going to work.
And that's a real science fiction story to say, you know, plucky regulators. That's
plucky regulators. Well, you know, the thing about, and I'm sure you know this, you know, the thing about everybody is that they, when it comes to humans, they all assume a spherical cow, yeah. Which is that humans are going to be, you know, perfect, you know, perfect entities who do exactly what you want them to do. You know, the great libertarian shibboleth is people will always act in their self-interest. You know, it doesn't make sense for them to pollute the river. They're going to act in their self-interest. They're going to drink out of the river. No, they're not. They're going to, you know, they're going to drink bottled water, you know, and they don't care, you know, that the cows down the road are, you know, going to die because the river's been poisoned, or the people for that matter. So, you know, the whole idea that people are perfect actors in any sort of way is ridiculous. I mean, there is a reason why I think so many Nobel Prizes have been awarded to the dudes who are like, you know, the humans are actually human, right? You can't actually expect them to, you know, act perfectly the way that you expect them to within your model. They're not cardboard characters. They do actually resort to, or they do actually are affected by inputs that are outside of their control, right? And there's always the, you know, there's always the tech, you know, billionaire who's like, what do you mean? No, of course they would do this. You know, we're disrupting such and such. And that makes perfect sense to do because humans will always act in this particular way. It's like, they absolutely will not. They absolutely will not work that way. And why does it work, you know, from the billionaire point of view? It's because, you know, the VC universe also believes in the shibboleth of perfect actors, because that's how they, you know, generate returns. And also by the time that the second and third order mess from, you know, building their business predicated on perfect humans plays out, they've already cashed out and moved on to the next thing. So,
yeah.
So as far as it goes, as much as I would like to live in a perfect world, as long as there are humans in there, I'm not going to get it. And I include myself. I am a extraordinarily flawed human, and I know where most of my flaws are, but I don't know where all of them are, and that's just literally the worst thing.
Well, somebody will tell you. Don't worry.
Oh, the internet tells me on a daily basis.
Yes. I mean, I studied economics, so I'm familiar with the spherical cows. And it doesn't seem to matter how many Nobel Prizes are won saying, you know, we're teaching this all wrong, right?
No.
The teaching doesn't change. It's still the exact same lesson every time.
But it's more than that. It's not that the teaching never changes, although you're correct about that, but also the people never change. I mean, the thing that famously said over the course of 15 years of being a science fiction author at this point is humans are still running 1.0 software up here. It was the software that was coded for when we were living on the savannah, right? It's why we eat entire bags of Doritos at one point. We're like, salt and oil. I need this for my body now. Cause who knows, the famine's going to come, you know, that sort of thing. Whereas in the real world, you know, it's probably not going to come. You might run out of toilet paper because of supply chain issues, but realistically, you're probably not going to run out of food.
In the developed world.
But because we are still running. Yeah, in the developed world, absolutely. But because we're still running that 1.0 software, everything that is beyond our perceptual horizon as a product of, as you note, development, as a product of society, as a product of upbringing, as a product of our age, right? You know, my daughter, who is 23, is now going through that initial shock of having young people not know the bands that she liked when she was 13. She's like, how can you not know A Simple Plan? You know, and in fact, they just have no idea.
Also Canadian.
Right? Yeah, that's great. Right.
Canadian institution, Simple Plan.
As far as it goes. All of these perceptual horizons are there. And also the fact that you can tell people as much as you can. You can teach them, and you can upgrade the teaching. You can do all that sort of stuff. And yet, there are some things that people cannot learn until they actually do them themselves. And also, at the end of the day, there'll be like, oh, no, I understand everything you're saying, but I still want to be really, really super filthy rich. So.
So I don't care.
Yeah, I don't care. Because at the end of this, I will have $1 billion. I will have $1 billion, and then I can continue not to care what you think, right? Is their thinking. Now, of course, you know, just like any pyramid scheme, most people aren't going to become billionaires or even millionaires. They're just going to sort of muddle along. But by that time, it's too late for them. But that's okay, because a new crop of people will be like, I'll show you, have showed up.
Absolutely.
In short, humans are the worst.
Well, we have limitations, and if we are not cognizant of them, I think, as you pointed out, insofar as we can be, we will be really fucked over by them.
Yeah.
It'll get us good.
Yes.
Yeah. So. Yeah. And this
now,
book.
I do tend to be an optimist. I do tend to be an optimist. I do tend to believe that humans eventually do the right thing, but only after they've done everything else wrong. So hopefully there's still some hope yet. I'm sorry, I stepped on your line. Go ahead.
No. I mean, like, I always feel obligated when we have these interviews to say, this book's a lot of fun. Like, it's a very fun book that has a lot of adventure. And it's not actually a book about energy regulators and civil society. And You know, that's,
I mean, it is about those things.
It is
as
about
well,
those things.
But it's also a very fun book, and it's an enjoyable read. And
yeah.
No, the good news is, I believe that your podcast listeners already know this about you guys, right?
Yeah.
Like, they're not listening to this podcast if they're like, why are they talking about economies and regulation again? Why do I don't understand. That's not what they come here for. They come here for this stuff.
That's true.
I hope so.
Yeah.
And also, thank you. I mean, I actually really did try to make this thing fun and enjoyable, because I'm a strong believer in the idea that you can put, you know, issues of energy, issues of global warming, issues of, you know, billionaire psychology, all of these things into your book and still have fun with it. You know, you have to create the context as the writer. You have to create the context where all of this stuff, you know, comes into the perceptual, umbra of the reader. But they're not like, you know, and now we're on the soapbox. It's just like, oh, this is all part of the whole thing. I get it. And they're still on the ride and they're still having a good time. I mean, that's supposed to be my job. My job is to give you a thrill ride. And at the end of it, you can be like, wow, they covered a lot of ground in that particular book, didn't they? I didn't notice it at the time because I was looking at the big monsters, but damn, that's the goal.
Yeah. And you know, something we always say is, like, even if you, as an author, don't consciously put those things in your book, they're going to be there anyway.
It's like, we live in a society, as they say, as the kids say.
As the kids, as the kids who are now 25 say.
Oh, yes, exactly. Well, like I said, I'm 52. I've had seven generations of memes and internet stuff go by. You know, it's like, when I started, kids, I was on the Usenet, and we liked it. I used Gopher. Yeah. That was a real protocol, not like this stuff you use with the Facebooks. Damn kids.
Really salty about BBSs.
Right.
No.
Right, exactly. I did. In high school, I actually co-ran our school BBS that operated at a blazing 300 BBS, right?
Okay, yeah.
And the thing is, you can see the exact same arguments today as I saw 35 years ago on the web school BBS. And you're like, oh, humans, why? Why do you even?
But is Black Sabbath better than Metallica? I just need to know.
I mean, let me break this down for you. This is like comparing different eras of baseball. You have dead ball era and you have the live ball era. You can't mix the two. Black Sabbath was doing the thing at a particular time. And Metallica was just apples
and
to
oranges.
Nuclear bombs.
Oh, wonderful. Okay, well, thank you. Thank you for the book. It was great. I'm glad we got to read it.
Oh, thank you. I'm glad you enjoyed it. And I'm glad it gave you things to think about.
Yeah, definitely did. Before we let you go, John, we were wondering if you had any recommendations for our listeners, anything you're reading, anything you've come across that maybe a little off the beaten path that you thought was cool or exciting.
I get a lot of books sent to me, like literally all the books in science fiction and fantasy. And so the ones that I have been recommending to people recently that have come out in basically like the last year. One of them is The Actual Star, which is by Monica Byrne, which, if you want to talk about interesting development of societies, the book takes place in three time periods, all of them 1,000 years apart from each other. 1012, 2012, 3012, and the way that she built up the society. I mean, speaking of world building, wow, right? So there's that. Reika Aoki wrote Light from Uncommon Stars, which takes place in the area of Southern California, which I grew up in, which is called the Eastern San Gabriel Valley. So I was immediately like, oh, I know all of these places. This is great. But then there's a whole different thing going on that, you know, crosses the streams of science fiction and fantasy and is kind of amazing. And then also Tochi Abiochi's Goliath, which just came out, which, again, posits a world that's not too far in the future, but has all the consequences of everything we're doing now. So it's got that for going for it, which is great. But it's extraordinarily well written, and absolutely can recommend that. So those are the three things that I would recommend to your readers and to you too, if you haven't read them by now.
I've only just started Goliath, so
yeah, we're working on Goliath right now.
Yeah, no, there's a lot going on there, so you know you'll be able to enjoy that.
It's been a good time so far.
Great. So the other thing that I'd like to ask, though, I mean, you're John Scalzi, so everyone knows. Where can people find you or find more about you?
This rising star, this indie kid, John Scalzi. You haven't heard of him yet, but he's going to be big. Which, by the way, I want to make very clear is still weird for me, where people are like, oh yeah, John Scalzi, everybody knows him. I was like, do they really?
I mean, if you're listening to this podcast, yes.
Right, the people listening to this podcast, yes, absolutely. I often compare being a, you know, world-class science fiction author to being a world-class bluegrass musician, which is, you are super, super well known to a very exclusive group and they love you. But the rest of the world has literally no idea who you are. So
I think that's probably the best
to my microphone is what I'm saying.
Yeah. Yeah. I like at work, I'll say, oh, I'm doing a podcast and I've got John Scalzi. Like who does that? Yeah. It's a big name. This is huge, people.
Don't you understand? What's wrong with you?
John, your Twitter is definitely worth a follow. Yeah, I recommend your Twitter to people. It's very entertaining. So if nothing else.
Well, thank you. If nothing else. So, yes, for the two people listening to this podcast out of the other several thousand who don't otherwise know who I am, one, just type Scalzi into Google. It'll pop up everything about me. But I have a website, which is called Whatever, that I've been on for 23 years now, because I'm old again, let's repeat that. It's lived through several internet, eras. It's survived Friendster and MySpace and Angelfire and LiveJournal, and it looks like it's going to survive Facebook. So that's great. It'll be around. Don't worry. As long as I'm alive, it'll be there. And then on Twitter, I'm Scalzi on Twitter. I have a Facebook page that's mostly just updates about what's going on with books and events and stuff like that. My website and Twitter are both the prime real estate if you want to get what's really going on with me in minute and probably way too much detail, because I am absolutely a Twitter junkie and I update my website every day. So, you know, it's not like I have a job. So yes, this is what I do.
That's more Twitter than I can do. That's for sure.
If you want to find out more about our show, you can find us on our website, androidsandassets.ca. Alternatively, you can find us on Instagram and Twitter at AssetDroid. And if you want to send us an old-fashioned email, you can reach us at info@androidsandassets.ca. We would absolutely love to hear from you, and we very much appreciate you listening to the show. You are a smart, talented, and wonderful person. So we're lucky to have you. So remember, next time you are surrounded by your fellow energy regulators at the water cooler, trying to sort out your schedule 35-8Bs from your schedule 35-8Cs, put us on for all the cubicles and water coolers adjacent. You won't regret it.